New York City, March 18th, 2014. 4. Addie is so many things, thinks Henry, but she is not forgettable. How could anyone forget this girl when she takes up so much space? She fills the room with stories, with laughter, with warmth and light. He has put her to work, or rather she has put herself to work, restocking and reshelving while he helps customers. She has called herself a ghost, and she may be one to other people, but Henry cannot look anywhere but at her. She moves among the books as if they're friends, and perhaps in a way they are. They are, he supposes, a part of her story, another thing she's touched. Here, she says, is a writer she once met, and here is an idea she had, here a book that she read when it first came out. Now and then, Henry glimpses sadness, glimpses longing, but they are only flashes, and then she redoubles, brightens, launching into another story. Did you know Hemingway? He asks. We met once or twice, she says with a smile. But Colette was cleverer. Book trails Addie like a shadow. He has never seen the cat so invested in another human, and when he asks, she draws a handful of treats from her pocket with a sheepish grin. Their eyes meet now across the store, and he knows she said she's not immune, that their deals simply work together, but the fact remains that there is no shimmer in those brown eyes. Her gaze is clear, a lighthouse through the fog. She smiles, and Henry's world goes brighter. She turns away, and it is dark again. A woman approaches the checkout desk, and Henry drags himself back. Find everything you need. Her eyes are already milky with shine. Oh, yes, the woman says with a warm smile, and he wonders what she sees instead of Henry. Is he a son, or a lover, a brother, a friend? Addie leans her elbows on the counter. She taps the book he's been turning through between customers, a collection of modern candids in New York. I noticed the cameras at your place, she says, and the photographs. They're yours, aren't they? Henry nods, resists the urge to say it's just a hobby, or rather, it was a hobby once. You're very good, she says, which is nice, especially coming from her. And he's fine, he knows, maybe even a little better than fine, sometimes. He took headshots for Robbie back in college, but that was because Robbie couldn't afford a real photographer. Muriel called his photos cute, subversive in their conventional way. But Henry wasn't trying to subvert anything, he just wanted to capture something. He looks down at the book. There's this family photo, he says. Not the one in the hall, this other one, from back when I was 6 or 7. That day was awful. Muriel put gum in David's book, and I had a cold, and my parents were fighting right up until the flash went off. And in the photo, we all look so happy. I remember seeing that picture and realizing that photographs weren't real. There's no context, just the illusion that you're showing a snapshot of a life, but life isn't snapshots, it's fluid. So photos are like fictions. I loved that about them. Everyone thinks photography is truth, but it's just a very convincing lie. Why did you stop? Because time doesn't work like photos. Click, and it stays still. Blink, and it leaps forward. He always thought of taking photos as a hobby, an art class credit, and by the time he figured out that it was something you could do, it was too late. Or at least, it felt that way. He was too many miles behind. So he gave up, put the cameras on the shelf with the rest of the abandoned hobbies. But something about Addie makes him want to pick one up again. He doesn't have a camera with him, of course, only his cell phone, but these days, that is good enough. He lifts it up, framing Addie at rest, the bookshelves rising at her back. It won't work, she says, right as Henry takes the picture. Or tries. He taps the screen, but there's no click, no capture. He tries again, and this time the phone takes the photo, but it is a blur. I told you, she says softly. I don't get it, he says. It was so long ago. How could he have predicted film or phones? Addie manages a sad smile. It's not the technology he tampered with. It's me. Henry pictures the stranger, smiling in the dark. He sets the phone down. New York City, September 5th, 2013. 5. Henry wakes to the blare of morning traffic. He winces at the sound of car horns, the sunlight streaming through the window. He reaches for the memories of last night and for a second comes up with nothing, a flat black slate, a cottony silence. But when he squeezes his eyes shut, the darkness cracks, gives way to a wave of pain and sadness, a medley of broken bottles and heavy rain, and a stranger in a black suit, a conversation that must have been a dream. Henry knows that Tabitha said no. That part was real, the memory too stinging to be anything but true. That is, after all, why he started drinking. The drinking is what led him home through the rain to rest on the stoop before going inside, and that is where the stranger... But no, that part didn't happen. The stranger and their conversation, that was the stuff of stories, a clear subconscious commentary, his demons played out in mental desperation. A headache thuds dully in Henry's skull, and he scrubs at his eyes with the back of one hand. A metal weight knocks against his cheek. He squints up and sees a dark leather band around his wrist, an elegant analog watch with gold numerals set against an onyx ground. On its face, a single golden hand rests the barest fraction off of midnight. Henry has never worn a watch. The sight of it, heavy and unfamiliar on his wrist, reminds Henry of a shackle. He sits up, clawing at the clasp, consumed by the sudden fear that it is bound to him, that it won't come off. But at the slightest pressure, the clasp comes free, and the watch tumbles onto the twisted duvet. It lands face down, and there, on the reverse, Henry sees two words etched in hairline script. Live well. He scrambles out of the bed, away from the watch, stares at the timepiece as if expecting it to attack, but it just lies there, silent. His heart knocks inside his chest, so loud he can hear it, and he is back in the dark, rain dripping through his hair as the stranger smiles and holds out his hand. Deal. But that didn't happen. Henry looks at his palm and sees the shallow cuts, crusted over with blood. Notices the drops of brownish red dotting the sheets. The broken bottle. That was real then, too. But the devil's hand in his, that was a fever dream. Pain can do that, creep from waking hours into sleep. Once, when he was 9 or 10, Henry had strep throat, the pain so bad that every time he drifted off to sleep, he dreamed of swallowing hot coals, of being trapped in burning buildings, the smoke clawing down his throat, the mind trying to make sense of suffering. But the watch. Henry can hear a low, rhythmic knocking as he holds it to his ear. It doesn't make any other sound. One night, soon, he will take the thing apart and find the body empty of cogs, empty of anything to explain the creeping forward motion. And yet, it is solid, heavy even, in his hand. It feels real. The knocking gets louder, and then he realizes it's not coming from the watch at all. It's just the solid thud of knuckles on wood, someone at his door. Henry holds his breath, waits to see if it will stop, but it doesn't. He backs away from the watch, the bed, grabs a clean shirt from the back of a chair. I'm coming, he mutters, dragging it over his head. The collar snags on his glasses, and he catches his shoulder on the doorframe, swearing softly, hoping all the way from the bedroom to the front door that the person beyond will give up, go away. They don't, so Henry opens the door, expecting to see Bea or Robbie, or maybe Helen down the hall, looking again for her cat. but it's his sister, Muriel. Muriel, who has been to Henry's place exactly twice in the last 5 years, and once it was because she had too much herbal tea at a lunch meeting and couldn't make it back to Chelsea. "What are you doing here?" he asks, but she is already brushing past him, unwinding a scarf that's more decorative than functional. Does family need a reason? The question is clearly rhetorical. She turns, her eyes sweeping over him, the way he imagines they sweep over exhibits, and he waits for her usual assessment, some variation of, "You look like shit." Instead, his sister says, "You're looking good." Which is strange, because Muriel has never been one to lie. She doesn't like to encourage fallacy in a world rife with empty speech. And a passing glance in the hall mirror is enough to confirm that Henry does, in fact, look almost as rough as he feels.
"Beatrice texted me last night when you didn't answer your phone," she continues. "She told me about Tabitha and the whole no-go. I'm sorry, Hen."
Muriel hugs him, and Henry doesn't know where to put his hands. They end up hovering in the air around her shoulders until she lets go.
"What happened? Was she cheating?"
And Henry wishes the answer were yes, because the truth is worse. The truth is that he simply wasn't interesting enough.
"It doesn't matter," continues Muriel. "Fuck her, you deserve better."
He almost laughs because he can't count how many times Muriel pointed out that Tabitha was out of his league. She glances around at the apartment.
"Did you redecorate? It's really cozy in here."
Henry surveys the living room, dotted with candles and art and other remnants of Tabitha. The clutter is his. The style was hers. "No." His sister is still standing. Muriel never sits, never settles, never even perches.
"Well, I can see you're fine," she says. "But next time, answer your phone." "Oh," she adds, taking her scarf back, already halfway to the door. "Happy New Year."
It takes him a moment to remember. Rosh Hashanah. Muriel sees the confusion on his face and grins.
"You would have made such a bad rabbi."
He doesn't disagree. Henry would normally go home, they both would, but David couldn't get away from his hospital shift this year, so their parents had made other plans.
"Are you going to Temple?" he asks now.
"No," says Muriel. "But there's a show uptown tonight, a kinky burlesque hybrid, and I'm pretty sure there's going to be some fire play. I'll light a candle on someone."
"Mom and Dad would be so proud," he says dryly.
But in truth, he suspects they would. Muriel Strauss can do no wrong. She shrugs.
"We all celebrate in our own way."
She twists the scarf back into place with a flourish.
"I'll see you for Yom Kippur."
Muriel reaches for the door, then turns back toward him and stretches up to ruffle Henry's hair.
"My little storm cloud," she says. "Don't let it get too dark in there."
And then she's gone, and Henry sags back against the door, dazed, tired, and thoroughly confused. Henry has heard that grief has stages. He wonders if the same is true for love. If it's normal to feel lost and angry and sad, hollow, and somehow, horribly, relieved. Maybe it's the thud of the hangover muddling all the things he should be feeling, churning them into what he does. He stops at Roast, the bustling coffee shop a block shy of the store. It has good muffins, halfway decent drinks, and terrible service, which is pretty much par for the course in this part of Brooklyn, and sees Vanessa working at the till. New York is full of beautiful people, actors and models moonlighting as bartenders and baristas, making drinks to cover rent until their first big break. He's always assumed Vanessa is one of those, a waifish blonde with a small infinity symbol tattooed inside one wrist. He also assumes her name is Vanessa. That's the name on the tag pinned to her apron, but she's never actually told him. Has never said anything to him, for that matter, besides, "What can I get you?" Henry will stand at the counter,
and she will ask his order and his name, even though he has been coming here 6 days a week for the last 3 years, and she's been there for two of them, and from the time she punches in his flat white to the time she writes his name on the cup and calls out for the next order, she will never look at him. Her gaze will flit from his shirt to the computer to his chin, and Henry will feel like he isn't even there. That's how it always goes. Only today, it doesn't. Today, when she takes his order, she looks up. It's such a small change, the difference of 2 inches, maybe three, but now he can see her eyes, which are a startling blue, and the barista looks at him, not his chin. She holds his gaze and smiles. "Hi there," she says. "What can I get you?" He orders a flat white and says his name, and that is where it ends. Then it doesn't. "Fun day planned?" she asks, making small talk as she writes his name on the cup. Vanessa has never made small talk with him before. "Just work," he says, and her attention flicks back to his face. This time, he catches a faint shimmer, a wrongness in her eyes. It's a trick of the light, it must be, but for a second, it looks like frost or fog. "What do you do?" she asks, sounding genuinely interested, and he tells her about the last word, and her eyes light up a little. She has always been a reader, and she cannot think of anywhere better than a bookstore. When he pays for the order, their fingers brush, and she cuts him another glance. "See you tomorrow, Henry." The barista says his name like she stole it, mischief tugging at her smile. And he can't tell if she's flirting until he gets his drink and sees the little black arrow she's drawn, pointing to the bottom, and when he tips it up to see, his heart gives a little thud like an engine turning over. She's written her name and number on the bottom of the cup. At the last word, Henry unlocks the grate and the door while finishing his coffee. He turns the sign and goes through the motions of feeding book and opening the store and shelving new stock until the bell chimes, announcing his first customer. Henry winds through the stacks to find an older woman toddling between the aisles, from historical to mystery to romance and back again. He gives her a few minutes, but when she makes the loop a third time, he steps in. "Can I help you?"
I don't know,
she murmurs, half to herself, but then she turns to look at him, and something changes in her face.
"I mean, yes, please, I hope so."
There's the faintest shine to her eyes, a roomy glow, as she explains that she's looking for a book she's already read.
"These days, I can't remember what I've read and what I haven't," she explains, shaking her head. "Everything sounds familiar. All the covers look the same. Why do they do that? Why do they make everything like everything else?"
Henry assumes it has to do with marketing and trends, but he knows that's probably not helpful to say. Instead, he asks if she remembers anything about it.
"Oh, let's see. It was a big book. It was about life and death, and history."
That doesn't exactly narrow it down, but Henry is used to the lack of details. The number of people who've come in, looking for something they've seen, able to supply nothing beyond "the cover was red," or "I think it had the word girl" in the title.
"It was sad and lovely," explains the old woman. "I'm sure it was set in England. Oh dear, my mind. I think it has a rose on the cover."
She looks around at the shelves, wrings her papery hands together, and she's clearly not going to decide, so he does. Desperately uncomfortable, he tugs a thick historical from the nearest fiction shelf.
"Was it this?"
he asks, offering Wolf Hall. But he knows the moment it's in his hand that it's not the one. There's a poppy on the cover, not a rose, and there's nothing particularly sad or lovely about the life of Thomas Cromwell, even if the writing is beautiful, poignant. "Never mind," he says, already reaching to put it back, when the old woman's face lights up with pleasure.
"That's it!"
She grabs his arm with bony fingers.
"That's exactly what I was looking for."
Henry has a hard time believing it, but the woman's joy is so clear that he begins to doubt himself. He is about to ring her up when he remembers. Atkinson, Life After Life. A book about life and death and history, sad and lovely, set in England with a twinned rose on the cover. Wait, he says, ducking around the corner and down the recent fiction aisle to retrieve the book. Is this it? The woman's face brightens exactly as it did before.
Yes, you clever thing, that's just the one, she says with the same conviction.
Happy I could help, he says, unsure if he did.
She decides to take both books, says she's sure that she will love them. The rest of the morning is just as strange. A middle-aged man comes in searching for a thriller and leaves with all five titles that Henry recommends. A college student comes looking for a book on Japanese mythology, and when Henry apologizes for not having it, she practically trips over herself to say it's not his fault and insists on letting him order it in for her, even though she isn't sure about the class. A guy with a model's build and a jaw sharper than a penknife comes to peruse their fantasy section, and he writes his email on the receipt beneath his signature when he pays. Henry feels off balance, the way he did when Muriel told him he looked good. It's like déjà vu and not like déjà vu at all, because the feeling is entirely new. It's like April Fool's, when the rules change and everything's a game and everyone else is in on it, and he's still marveling over the last encounter, face a little flushed, when Robbie bursts in through the door, chime ringing in his wake. Oh my God, he says, throwing his arms around Henry, and for a moment he thinks something awful must have happened, before realizing that it already happened to him.
It's okay, says Henry,
and of course it's not, but today has been so weird that everything before it feels a little like a dream. Or maybe this is the dream? If it is, he's not all that eager to wake up.
It's okay, he says again.
It doesn't have to be okay, says Robbie. I just want you to know I'm here. I would have been there last night, too. I wanted to come over when you didn't answer your phone, but B said we should give you space, and I don't know why I listened. I'm sorry. It comes out in a single stream of words. Robbie's grip tightens as he talks, and Henry savors the embrace. They fit together with the familiar comfort of a well-worn coat. The hug lingers a little too long. Henry clears his throat and pulls back, and Robbie gives an awkward laugh and turns away, his face catching the light, and Henry notices a fine streak of purple along Robbie's temple, right where it meets his sandy hairline.
You're glittering.
Robbie scrubs half-heartedly at the makeup. Oh, rehearsal. There's an odd shine in Robbie's eyes, a glassiness Henry knows too well, and he wonders if Robbie's on something, or if it's simply been a while since he slept. Back in college, Robbie would get so high on drugs, or dreams, or big ideas, that he'd have to burn all the energy out of his system, and then he'd crash. The door chimes.
Son of a bitch,
announces B, slamming her satchel down on the counter.
Ostrich-minded motherfucker!
Customers, warns Henry, even though the only one currently nearby is a deaf older man, a regular named Michael, who frequents the horror section.
To what do we owe this tantrum?
Asks Robbie cheerfully. Drama always puts him in a good mood.
My asshole advisor!
She says, storming past them toward the art and art history section. They share a look and trail after her.
He didn't like the proposal? Asks Henry.
B has been trying to get a dissertation topic approved for the better part of a year.
He turned it down!
She whips down an aisle, nearly toppling a pile of magazines. Henry follows behind her, doing his best to right the destruction in her wake.
He said it was too esoteric. As if he'd know the meaning of the word if it blew him.
Use it in a sentence,
asks Robbie, but she ignores him, reaching up to pull down a book.
That closed-minded,
and another,
stale-brained,
and another,
corpse.
This isn't a library, says Henry as she carries the pile to the low leather chair in the corner and slumps into it, startling the orange lump of fur from between a pair of worn pillows.
Sorry, book, she mutters, lifting the cat gingerly onto the back of the old chair, where he does his best impression of an inconvenienced bread loaf.
B continues to emit a low stream of curses as she turns the pages.
I know just what we need, says Robbie, turning toward the storeroom.
Doesn't Meredith keep a stash of whiskey in the back?
And even though it's only 3 p.m., Henry doesn't protest. He sinks onto the floor, sits with his back to the nearest shelf, legs stretched long, feeling suddenly, unbearably tired. B looks up at him, sighs.
I'm sorry, she starts, but Henry waves her away.
Please continue trashing your advisor and my art history section. Someone has to behave normally.
But she closes the book, adds it back to the pile, and joins Henry on the floor.
Can I tell you something?
Her voice goes up at the end, but he knows it's not a question.
I'm glad you broke it off with Tabitha.
A lance of pain, like the cut across his palm.
She broke it off with me.
B waves her hand as if that small detail doesn't matter.
You deserve someone who loves you as you are, the good and the bad and the maddening.
You want to be loved. You want to be enough. Henry swallows.
Yeah, well, being me hasn't worked out so well.
B leans toward him.
But that's the thing, Henry. You haven't been you. You waste so much time on people who don't deserve you, people who don't know you because you don't let them know you.
B cups his face, that strange shimmer in her eyes.
Henry, you're smart and kind and infuriating. You hate olives and people who talk during movies. You love milkshakes and people who can laugh until they cry. You think it's a crime to turn ahead to the end of a book. When you're angry, you get quiet, and when you're sad, you get loud, and you hum when you're happy.
And?
And I haven't heard you hum in years.
Her hands fall away.
But I've seen you eat a shit ton of olives.
Robbie comes back, holding the bottle and three mugs. The last words only customer toddles out, and then Robbie shuts the door behind him, turning the sign to closed. He comes and sits between Henry and B on the floor and uncorks the bottle with his teeth.
What are we drinking to? Asks Henry.
To new beginnings, says Robbie, eyes still shining as he fills the cups. New York City, March 18th, 2014. 6. The bell chimes and B strides in.
Robbie wants to know if you're avoiding him, she says, in lieu of hello.
Henry's heart sinks. The answer is yes, of course, and no. He cannot shake the look of hurt in Robbie's eyes, but it doesn't excuse the way he acted, or maybe it does.
I'll take that as a yes, says B.
And where have you been hiding? Henry wants to say, I saw you at the dinner party, but wonders if she has forgotten the entire night or just the parts that Addie touched.
Speaking of, B, this is Addie.
Beatrice turns toward her, and for a second, and only a second, Henry thinks that she remembers. It's the way she's looking at Addie, as if she is a piece of art, but one that B has encountered before. Despite everything, Henry expects her to nod, to say, oh, good to see you again. Instead, B smiles. She says, you know, there's something timeless about your face. And he's rocked by the strangeness of the echo, the force of the déjà vu. But Addie only smiles and says, I've heard that before. As B continues to study Addie, Henry studies her. She has always been ruthlessly polished, but today there's neon paint on her fingers, a kiss of gold at her temple, what looks like powdered sugar on her sleeve.
What have you been doing? He asks.
She looks down.
Oh, I was at the artifact, she says,
as if that's supposed to mean something. Seeing his confusion, she explains. The artifact is, according to Beatrice, part carnival and part art exhibit, an interactive medley of installations on the High Line. As B talks about mirrored chambers and glass domes full of stars, sugar clouds, the plume from pillow fights, and murals made of 1,000 strangers' notes, Addie brightens, and Henry thinks it must be hard to surprise a girl who's lived 300 years. So when she turns to him, eyes bright, and says, "We have to go," there's nothing he'd rather do. There is, of course, the matter of the store, the fact he is the sole employee, and there are still 4 hours until closing. But he has an idea. Henry grabs a bookmark, the store's only piece of merchandise, and begins writing on the backside. "Hey, B," he says, pushing the makeshift card across the counter. "Can you close up?" "I have a life," she says, but then she looks down at Henry's tight and slanting script. "The Library of the Last Word." B smiles and pockets the card. "Have fun," she says, waving them out. New York City, September 5th, 2013. 7. Sometimes Henry wishes he had a cat. He supposes he could just adopt Book, but the tabby feels indivisible from the last word, and he can't shake the superstitious belief that if he tried to extricate the ancient cat from the secondhand shop, it would turn to dust before he got it home. Which is, he knows, a morbid way of thinking about people and places, or in this case, pets and places, but it's dusk, and he drank a little too much whiskey, and B had to go teach a class, and Robbie had a friend's show, so he's alone again, heading back to an empty apartment, wishing he had a cat or something waiting for him to come home. He tests out the phrase as he walks in. "Hi, kitty, I'm home," he says, before realizing that it makes him a 28-year-old bachelor talking to an imaginary pet, and that feels infinitely worse. He grabs a beer from the fridge, stares down at the bottle opener, and realizes it belongs to Tabitha, a pink and green thing in the shape of a lucha libre from a trip she took to Mexico City last month. He tosses it aside, opens a kitchen drawer looking for another, and finds a wooden spoon, a dance company magnet, a handful of ridiculous bendy straws, looks around, then sees a dozen more things strewn around the apartment, all of them hers. He digs up a box of books and turns them out, begins filling it again with photographs, note cards, paperbacks, a pair of ballet flats, a mug, a bracelet, a hairbrush, a photograph. He finishes the first beer, opens a second on the edge of the counter, and keeps going, moving from room to room, less a methodic procession than a lost wander. An hour later, the box is only half full, but Henry's losing steam. He doesn't want to do this anymore, doesn't even want to be here in an apartment that somehow feels both empty and cluttered. There's too much space to think. There's not enough to breathe. Henry sits between the empty beer bottles and the half-filled box for several minutes, knee bouncing, and then surges to his feet and goes out. The merchant is busy. It always is, one of those neighborhood bars whose success owes more to its sheer proximity than to the quality of its drinks, a local institution. Most of the people who frequent the merchant refer to it simply as the bar. Henry weaves through the crowd, grabs a stool at the edge of the counter, hoping the ambient noise of the place will make him feel a little less alone. Mark's on shift tonight, a 50-something with gray sideburns and a catalog smile. It normally takes a good 10 minutes to flag him down, but tonight, the bartender comes straight to him, ignoring the cue. Henry orders tequila, and Mark comes back with a bottle and a pair of shots. "On the house," he says, pouring himself a matching glass. Henry manages a wan smile. "Do I look that rough?" But there's no pity in Mark's gaze, only a strange and subtle light. "You look great," he says, "just like Muriel, and it's the first time he's said more than a single line, his answers usually limited to drink orders and nods. Their glasses knock together, and Henry orders a second, and a third. He knows he is drinking too much too fast, piling liquor on top of the beers from home, the whiskey he'd poured at work. A girl comes up to the bar and glances at Henry. She looks away, and then back again, as if seeing him for the first time. And there it is again, that shine, a film of light over her eyes as she leans in, and he can't seem to catch her name, but it doesn't matter. They do their best to talk over the noise, her hand resting at first on his forearm, then his shoulder, before sliding through his hair.
"Come home with me," she says, and he's so caught by the longing in her voice, the open want.
But then her friends come along and peel her away, their own eyes shining as they say, "Sorry," say, "You're such a good guy," say, "Have a great night." Henry slides off the stool and heads for the bathroom, and this time he can feel the ripple, the heads turning toward him. A guy catches his arm and says something about a photography project, how he'd be a perfect fit, before sliding him his card. Two women try to draw him into the circle of their conversation.
"I wish I had a son like you," says one.
"Son?" says the other with a raucous laugh as he twists free, escapes down the hall and into the toilets, braces himself against the counter. He has no idea what's happening. He thinks back to the coffee shop that morning, Vanessa's number on the bottom of the cup, to the customers in the store, all so eager for his help, to Muriel, who told him he looked well, to the pale fog like candle smoke in all of their eyes. He looks down at the watch on his wrist, glinting in the bathroom light, and for the first time, he's certain that it's real, that the man in the rain was real, the deal was real.
"Hey."
He looks up and sees a guy, glassy-eyed and smiling at Henry like they are the best of friends.
"You look like you could use a bump."
He holds out a little glass jar, and Henry stares at the tiny column of powder inside. He was 12 the first time he got high. Someone handed him a joint behind the bleachers, and the smoke burned his lungs, and he almost threw up. But then everything went a little soft. Weed made space in his skull, eased the nervous terror in his heart. But he couldn't control the places it took his head. Valium and Xanax were better, dulling everything at once. But he's always stayed away from the harder stuff, out of fear, not the fear that something would go wrong, just the opposite. The fear it would feel right. The fear of the slip, the slide, of knowing he wouldn't be strong enough to stop. It's never been the high he craved anyway, not exactly. It's just the quiet, that happy side effect. He tried to be better for Tabitha, but Tabitha's gone, and it doesn't matter anyway. Not anymore. Now, Henry just wants to feel good. He taps the powder onto his thumb, has no idea if he's doing it right, but he inhales, and it hits like a sudden, jolting cold, and then the world opens. The details clear, the colors brighten, and somehow everything gets sharp and fuzzy at the same time. Henry must have said something, because the guy laughs, and then he reaches out and wipes a fleck from Henry's cheek, and the contact is like static shock, a spark of energy where skin meets skin.
"You're perfect," says the stranger,
fingers drifting down his jaw, and Henry flushes with a dizzy heat that makes him need to move.
"Sorry," he says, backing out into the hall.
He slumps against the darkened wall, waits for the world to steady.
"Hey."
He looks up and sees a guy with his arms slung around a girl's shoulders, both of them long and lean and feline.
"What's your name?" asks the guy.
"Henry."
"Henry," echoes the girl with a cat-like smile. She looks at him with such obvious desire, he actually rocks back on his heels. No one has ever looked at him that way. Not Tabitha, not Robbie, no one. Not on the first date, or in the middle of sex, or when he got down on one knee.
I'm Lucia, she says. This is Benji, and we've been looking for you.
What did I do? He asks. Her smile tilts.
Nothing yet.
She bites her lip, and the guy looks at Henry, his face slack with longing, and at first he doesn't realize what they're talking about. And then he does. Laughter rolls through him, a strange, unbridled thing. He's never been in a threesome, unless you count that one time in school when he and Robbie and one of their friends got incredibly drunk and he's still not entirely sure how far things went.
Come with us,
she says, holding out her hand. And a dozen excuses spill through his mind and then out again, as Henry follows them home. New York City, September 7th, 2013. 8. God, it feels good to be wanted. Everywhere he goes, he can feel the ripple, the attention shifting toward him. Henry leans into the attention, the smiles, the warmth, the light. For the first time, he truly understands the concept of being drunk with power. It's like setting down a heavy weight long after your arms have gotten tired. There's this sudden, sweeping lightness, like air in your chest, like sunlight after rain. It feels good to be the user instead of the used, to be the one who gets instead of the one who loses. It feels good. It shouldn't, he knows, but it does. He stands in line at the roast, desperately needing coffee. The last few days have been a blur, late nights giving way to strange mornings, every moment fueled by the heady pleasure of being wanted, of knowing that whatever they see, it's good, it's great, it's perfect. He's perfect. And it's not just the straightforward gravity of lust, not always. People drift toward him now, every one of them pulled into his orbit, but the why is always different. Sometimes it's just simple desire, but other times it's more nuanced. Sometimes it's an obvious need, and other times he can't guess what they see when they look at him. That's the only unsettling part, really. Their eyes, the fog that winds through them, thickening to frost, to ice. A constant reminder that this new life isn't exactly normal, isn't entirely real. But it's enough. Next! He steps forward and looks up and sees Vanessa. Oh, hi, he says.
You didn't call.
But she doesn't sound angry or annoyed. If anything, she sounds too bright, teasing. But it's the kind of teasing used to cover up embarrassment. He should know. He's used that tone a dozen times to hide his own hurt. I'm sorry, he says, blushing. I wasn't sure if I should. Vanessa smiles slyly.
Was the whole name and number thing too subtle?
Henry laughs and hands his cell across the counter. Call me, he says, and she taps her number in and hits call. There, says Henry, taking back the phone. Now I have no excuse. He feels like an idiot even as he says it, like a kid reciting movie lines, but Vanessa only blushes and bites her bottom lip, and he wonders what would happen if he told her to go out with him right then, if she would take off her apron and duck beneath the counter, but he doesn't try it, just says, I'll call. And she says, you better. Henry smiles, turns to go. He's almost to the door when he hears his name.
Mr. Strauss.
Henry's stomach drops. He knows the voice, can picture the older man's tweed jacket, his salt and pepper hair, the look of disappointment on his face as he advised Henry to step away from the department, the school, and try to figure out where his passion was, because it clearly wasn't there. Henry tries to muster a smile, feels himself falling short. Dean Melrose, he says, turning to face the man who pushed him off the road. And there he is, flesh and bone and tweed. But instead of the contempt Henry got so used to seeing, the dean looks pleased. A smile splits his trim gray beard.
"What a lucky turn," he says. "You're just the man I wanted to see."
Henry has a hard time believing that, until he notices the pale smoke twisting through the man's eyes. And he knows he should be polite, but what he wants to do is tell the dean to go fuck himself, so he splits the difference and simply asks, "Why?"
"There's a position opening in the theology school, and I think you'd be perfect for it."
Henry almost laughs.
"You've got to be kidding."
"Not at all.
I never finished my PhD. You failed me."
The dean holds up a finger.
"I didn't fail you."
Henry bristles.
"You threatened to if I didn't leave."
"I know,"
he says, looking genuinely sorry.
"I was wrong."
Three words he's sure this man has never used. Henry wants to savor them, but he can't.
"No," he says, "you were right. It wasn't a good fit. I wasn't happy there, and I have no desire to go back."
It's a lie. He misses the structure, misses the path, misses the purpose, and maybe it wasn't a perfect fit, but nothing is.
"Come in for an interview," says Dean Melrose, holding out his card. "Let me change your mind."
"You're late."
B's waiting on the bookstore steps. "Sorry," he says, unlocking the door.
"Still not a library,"
he adds as she slaps a $5 bill on the counter and disappears into the art section. She makes a non-committal uh-huh, and he can hear her pulling books from the shelves. B is the only one who hasn't changed, the only one who doesn't seem to treat him differently.
"Hey," he says, following her down the aisle, "do I look strange to you?"
"No,"
she says, scanning the shelves.
"B, look at me."
She turns, gives him a long up and down appraisal.
"You mean besides the lipstick on your neck?"
Henry blushes, wiping at his skin.
"Yeah," he says, "besides that."
She shrugs.
"Not really."
But it's there, in her eyes, that unmistakable shimmer, a faint and iridescent film that seems to spread as she studies him.
"Really? Nothing?"
She pulls a book from the shelf.
"Henry, what do you want me to say?" she asks, searching for a second. "You look like you."
"So you don't..."
He doesn't know how to ask.
"You don't want me, then?"
B turns and looks at him for a long moment and then bursts out laughing.
"Sorry, hon,"
she says when she catches her breath.
"Don't get me wrong, you're cute, but I'm still a lesbian."
And the moment she says it, he feels absurd and absurdly relieved.
"What's this about?" she asks.
"I made a deal with the devil, and now whenever anyone looks at me, they see only what they want."
He shakes his head.
"Nothing. Never mind."
"Well," she says, adding another book to her stack, "I think I found a new thesis."
She carries the books back up to the counter and spreads them out on top of the ledgers and receipts. Henry watches her turn through the pages until she finds what she's looking for in each, then steps back so he can see what she's found. Three portraits, all of them renditions of a young woman, though they clearly come from different times and different schools.
"What am I looking at?" he asks.
"I call her the ghost in the frame."
One is a pencil sketch, the edges rough, unfinished. In it, the woman lies on her stomach, tangled in sheets. Hair pools around her, and her face is little more than panes of a shadow, a faint scattering of freckles across her cheeks. The title of the piece is written in Italian.
Ho portato la stella a letto.
The English translation sits beneath. I took the stars to bed. The second piece is French, a more abstract portrait, done in the vivid blues and greens of Impressionism.
The woman sits on a beach, a book face down on the sand beside her. She looks over her shoulder at the artist, only the edge of her face visible, her freckles little more than smudges of light, absences of color. La Sirène, this one is called. The Siren. The last piece is a shallow carving, a silhouette sculpture shot through with light, pinpoint tunnels burrowed through a pane of cherry wood. Constellation.
Do you see it?
Asks B.
They're portraits.
No, she says. They're portraits of the same woman.
Henry lifts a brow.
That's a stretch.
Look at the angle of her jaw, the line of her nose, and the freckles. Count them.
Henry does. In every image, there are exactly seven. B touches the first and second.
The Italian one's from the turn of the 19th century. The French one is 50 years later. And this one, she says, tapping the photo of the sculpture, this one's from the 60s.
So maybe one was inspired by the other, says Henry. Wasn't there a tradition of, I forget what it was called, but basically visual telephone? One artist favored something, and then another artist favored that artist, and so on, like a template.
But B is already waving him away.
Sure, in lexicons and bestiaries, but not in formal schools of art. This is like putting a girl with a pearl earring in a Warhol and a Degas without ever seeing the Rembrandt. And even if she became a template, the fact is this template influenced centuries of art. She's a piece of connective tissue between eras.
So, echoes Henry.
So who was she?
Bee's eyes are bright, the way Robbie's sometimes are when he's just nailed a performance or done a bump of coke, and Henry doesn't want to bring her down, but she's clearly waiting for him to say something.
Okay, he starts gently. But Bee, what if she was no one? Even if these are based on the same woman, what if the first artist simply made her up?
B frowns, already shaking her head. Look, he says, no one wants you to find your thesis topic more than I do, for the sake of this store as much as your sanity. And this all sounds cool, but didn't your last proposal get nixed for being too whimsical?
Esoteric.
Right, says Henry. And if a topic like postmodernism and its effects on New York architecture was too esoteric, how do you think Dean Parrish will feel about this?
He gestures to the open texts, the freckled faces staring up from every page. B looks at him in silence for a long moment, and then at the books.
Fuck! She shouts, taking up one of the giant books and storming out of the shop.
Henry watches her go and sighs.
Not a library, he calls after her,
returning the rest to their shelves.